Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Balak. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Balak. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior member of the Pardes faculty and also serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Balak. In previous podcasts, we have looked at the personality of Bilam. We have examined the various blessings which he gave to the Jewish people. Today I would like to look at Balak, at the people of Moab, and their relationship with the Jewish people. To truly understand our parsha, we need to do intertextual study, to somehow frame our parsha in a much larger context, beginning with the book of Bereishit, and ending with the book of Ruth. I would like to begin with a verse that appears in chapter 23 of Deuteronomy, verse 4. The beginning of chapter 23 outlines a whole variety of people who are prohibited from marrying normative Jews. And in chapter 23, verse 4, we are told, Lo yavo amonim u'moavi bekahal Hashem gam dor asiri, Lo yavo lahem bekahal Hashem ad olam. Someone from Ammon, someone from Moab, is prohibited from marrying a Jew, even if that person is converted, even if we are going down 10 generations of converts, they still are prohibited from marrying a regular Jew. This rule goes against all of the other examples of conversion. We know that there is no prohibition of a convert to marry a regular Jew. And once they've converted, their origins somehow fade away, and we do everything to try to integrate them into the Jewish people. This verse is exclusionary. It is creating a barrier between the peoples of Ammon and Moab and the Jewish people. And the Torah goes on to explain what is the rationale behind this. And it says in the following verse, Al dvar asher lo kidmu atchem balechem uvamayim bederech betzeitchem imitzrayim. Because they didn't go out to greet you with bread and water when you came out of the land of Egypt. And then it says, beyond that, and they hired Bilam, the son of Beor, from Midian, to go and curse you. The second explanation is clearly articulated in our parsha. Balak, the king of Moab, sees what the Jewish people have done to the Amorites at the end of last week's parsha. When the Jewish people go to Sichon in Og, in chapter 21, and ask them for rite of passage through their land, they refuse, and not only refuse, but go out with an army. And the Jews are giving the green light to fight them, utterly destroying them and taking possession of their lands. Balak, the king of Moab, sees this. He is demoralized. He knows that there is no way that he can go and fight the Jewish people. But even more so, he is concerned that if he allows the Jewish people a rite of passage through his land, because of their numbers, they'll create damage, havoc. He is revolted by his situation. And so he sees that the only solution that he has is to hire Bilam, a recognized soothsayer with magical powers, who has the ability to curse and thereby neutralize the threat of the Jewish people. But if that is the reason, so then it should be Moab that is basically excluded from entry into the Jewish people. Why Ammon? And if I go by the explanation, they didn't go out to greet you with bread and water. But Edom didn't do that either. They in fact gathered an army. And nevertheless, we're told that Edom is our brother. The third generation is allowed to marry into the Jewish people. I think that in order to be able to understand this verse from Deuteronomy, we have to actually see that the origins of this prohibition go back to the story of Lot and Abraham. So first of all, let us recall, Ammon and Moab are descended from Lot. In chapter 19 in the book of Genesis, Bereshit, God destroys the metropolis of Sodom. In the process, God saves Lot. Lot requests to be allowed to find refuge in a certain town, Tzoar, one of the cities of Sodom. But eventually, he goes up into the mountains. His daughters think that the world has been destroyed. There is no future. And with good motivations, in their desire to perpetuate humanity, they get their father drunk, sleep with him, and become pregnant. The elder daughter bearing Moab, the younger one, Ammon. I would like to argue that the prohibition of integrating Ammon and Moab is because of their being the descendants of Lot. And this, in fact, goes back to what happened in chapter 14 in Bereshit. In chapter 14, we're told of a mega battle between four kings who are from the area of Ashur, from Mesopotamia, who are fighting the five kings of Sodom. The five kings of Sodom are utterly defeated. And in the process, their wives and children and possessions are taken by the victors. Lot is among those who are taken captive. And when Abram hears of what happened, he immediately decides to engage those four kings in battle. Miraculously, he defeats them. Miraculously, he saves Lot, and not only Lot, but Sodom. And when Abraham comes back from his victory, we are told how a king, Malkitzedek, the king of Shalem, goes out to greet Abraham with bread and wine, blesses Abraham, acknowledges that Abraham's victory is because El Elyon, a higher power, has handed his enemies into his hand. But the gestures and the words of the king of Malkitzedek are in sharp contrast to the king of Sodom, but even more so to the absolute silence of Lot. Abraham, who was ready to give up his life to save his nephew, what is the reaction of his nephew? Slamming the door in the face of his uncle. No thanks, no gratitude, no going back to Abraham. And perhaps this is the reason why the Torah said, do not integrate the peoples of Ammon and Moab into the Jewish people, because their ancestor Lot rejected you. He had a golden opportunity to come back into the fold. And instead, in the aftermath of these battles, he went back to Sodom. He put himself on a course where he totally cut himself off from Abraham. And even after Sodom was destroyed, he did not go back. In theory, our parsha could have been a corrective to what Lot did. When the Jewish people are on the borders of Ammon and Moab, they could have come out to greet us. They could have embraced us. There could have been an historic reconciliation. In Deuteronomy, we are told in chapter 2, God explicitly told Moses, when you approach the border of Moab and Ammon, do not engage them in battle. Do not harass them. You have no right to take possession of their land, because I have given this land to Lot, to his heirs. In effect, what God was saying to Moshe and the Jewish people is, Lot and his heirs are your brethren. And perhaps this opened up the door for a reconciliation. But instead, what we find in our parsha is that Balak, the king of Moab, does not seek reconciliation. Instead, he sees the Jews as a threat, as his enemy, and his gesture is to curse them. He doesn't succeed because ultimately God thwarts both his and Bilaam's desire to curse the Jews. But he does succeed in another way. When Bilaam finishes blessing the Jews, he says to Balak at the end of chapter 24, "Let me now advise you as to what will be." And according to the rabbinic understanding, his advice to Balak is, "I cannot curse the Jews, but perhaps we can create a wedge between the Jews and God. We can somehow undermine that relationship, and in so doing, destroy the Jewish people." And that is what we find at the end of our parsha, in the beginning of chapter 25, when it says that the Jewish people settle down in Shittim, and they begin prostituting with the daughters of Moab. According to the rabbinic understanding, it didn't just happen. This is part of a scheme, initially to get the Jews to prostitute with the daughters of Moab, but eventually to have them worship idolatry, Baal Peor, a very revolting type of form of idolatry, the worshiping defecation before an idol. And this scheme succeeded. As we're told at the end of the parsha, 24,000 men die in a plague. So to sum up, the prohibition of integrating Ammon and Moab perhaps has its origins in the story of Lot in chapter 14 of Bereishit. But there was the possibility of reversing that, which was our parsha. And Balak, together with Bilaam, instead of reversing that, took it to its absolute low. So that our parsha creates what might be seen as the final rupture between the Jewish people and the people of Moab, and connected with that, the people of Ammon, which leads to the prohibition in Deuteronomy. But there is a happy ending. Last week, we had an executive learning seminar at Pardes, which was very successful, a lot of good learning, and the topic was From Rags to Royalty, Ruth and Esther. And I would like to share with you a few thoughts which came out in terms of Ruth. Ruth is in fact the corrective to not only the story of Lot, but to our parsha. First and foremost, Ruth is a woman of chesed, of kindness, of giving, of devotion, dedication. But not only is she devoted, Ruth begins the story by saying to Naomi, "I want to go with you. Your people are my people. Your God is my God." Ruth is looking to come back into a relationship with the Jewish people. And although she is doing this as Ruth, the individual, this has cosmic implications. What else do we see about Ruth? Ruth is a woman of modesty. Her modesty is clearly a 180-degree turn from the prostitution of the daughters of Moab. And I might even add, is a reversal of what happened with Lot and his daughters. Yes, there is a scene in the book of Ruth where Boaz is alone in the granary at night and where she reveals his legs, sleeps by his legs, which could be a euphemism for sexual relations. But everything is done in a much different way than with Lot and his daughters. Ruth does not get Boaz drunk. And if she did have sexual relations, it is not something which is overtly in the text. And certainly, she does not become pregnant from that and commemorate that event by naming her child. Instead, what does Ruth do? She pushes Boaz to do things through the legal channels. She ultimately pushes Boaz, according to the rabbinic understanding, to reinterpret that verse in Deuteronomy so that it is the males who are excluded, but not the females, to now make it perfectly legal for a Jewish man to marry a Moabite convert. She wants this to be something which will be acknowledged by the community, and I would even say perpetuated forever. In this week's Haftarah, which is from the book of Micha, On the one hand, the connection to the Parsha is because at one point Micha says, remember what Balak, the king of Moab, wanted to do to you and how he failed in his attempt. But perhaps on another level, the connection between the Haftarah and the Parsha is what it says at the very end. Son of man, or man I should say, if someone will say, what is good? The answer is, do justice, love kindness, walk modestly before your God. The Talmud in Masechet Makot says, Micha reduced all of Judaism to three principles. Hirsch, in his commentary, says that these three principles were reflected in what appears earlier, in an earlier verse in Micha, where God says, I gave you three leaders who took you out of Egypt, Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam. And Hirsch says, Moshe is the embodiment of doing justice. Aaron is the embodiment of loving kindness. Miriam is associated with walking modestly before God. And Ruth incorporates all of those qualities. Hence, Ruth is the person who is fit to bring about that reconciliation, that integration between Moab and Israel. She is someone who, rather than rejecting the Jewish people, rejecting the God of the Jewish people, not only embraces it, but perhaps brings back to the Jewish people all of those qualities that may have gotten lost in her generation. Ruth is the corrective to Balak, and according to one rabbinic understanding, in fact, was a descendant of Balak. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.